Welcome to the Jurisdictions Podcast. My name is Flora Bintanou, and I'll be your host. In this episode, we focus on international sports law and the governance of football. But why would an international law podcast focus on football? Well, because football is a global phenomenon. With billions of fans worldwide, tournaments like the FIFA World Cup, the Champions League, and domestic leagues that attract massive audiences, football fuels a multi-billion dollar industry. In 2022, during the Men's World Cup final between Argentina and France, FIFA reports that the audience reached 1.42 billion viewers across the globe. But it isn't just about the game. It's about identity, passion, and deep-rooted connections between fans and their clubs. That influence also extends beyond the pitch. The video game industry has capitalized on this passion, with games like Football Manager that allows players to step into the role of a club manager, handling transfers, tactics, and the pressures of professional football. But what exactly is a transfer? How does the transfer system work? And are we really talking about the buying and selling of athletes? Surely not, right? More recently, students of international law and football fans alike may have heard about the recent Diarra judgment by the Court of Justice of the European Union, or CJEU, and how this has reshaped the legal landscape by addressing the balance between a player's right to move freely under EU law and the financial protections granted to clubs under the transfer regulations of the International Federation of Association Football, commonly known as FIFA. It is a ruling that further highlighted the ongoing tension between regulatory control, market forces, and the legal rights of athletes, a dynamic that sits at the intersection of sports law and transnational governance. But what is meant when lawyers refer to transnational law and governance? Are we talking about something other than international law? More broadly, what legal and ethical issues arise from the current structure of football's regulatory system? How do these regulations impact players' rights, particularly in relation to labor and contractual freedom? And what further concerns do these questions invite us to consider? To discuss all of this, we are joined by Dr. Antoine Duval, a senior researcher at the Asser Institute, who heads the Asser International Sports Law Center and has been thinking through these questions throughout his academic career. But it is not the halls of academia that sparked an interest in these questions. It was his time playing Football Manager as a young football fan, and a specific moment in that game where he was confronted with a ruling that would impact his virtual trading season.
It's where it all started in a way for me. And in that game, there was an interesting moment. I think it's when you were playing the 2002 or 2003 version of the game. At one point, you were moving from one year to the other, and you would get a news flash that the new transfer system following the Bosman judgment was coming into force and was changing the way you could acquire and sell players. And I must say that acquiring and selling players was just something that felt so counterintuitive in terms of, I mean, I had learned that slavery had been abolished way long ago, and I couldn't really wrap my head around why that was the case, that we were buying and selling people.
The Bosman judgment that Dr. Duval mentions refers to a case brought before what was then the European Court of Justice by Belgian footballer Jean-Marc Bosman, who could not transfer from RFC Liège to a French club due to a dispute over a transfer fee. When the French club refused to pay the fee demanded by RFC Liège, Bosman was left without a contract. The central issue in this case was whether imposing such a fee after a contract's expiration violated EU law. The court ruled that the system did indeed breach EU law, specifically the freedom of movement for workers as per Article 39 of the EC Treaty. This article guarantees the free movement of workers within the European Union, prohibiting discrimination based on nationality between workers of member states. As a result, players were allowed to transfer freely to new clubs once their contracts expired, without the new club owing a transfer fee. This landmark ruling fundamentally transformed the European football transfer market, granting players greater contractual freedom. It might seem odd to talk about buying and selling players, but as Dr. Duval explains, that is not what happens in a football transfer.
What is a transfer? You don't buy a player. A player is not an asset. It's not a car. You cannot buy a player. What do you buy then? They are not buying the contract in a sense that they are not replacing the former club in the labor contract. A new labor contract is signed. What you buy is actually you buy peace on the breach of the contract. So what you buy is the right of the club to entertain a claim against the player and against a new club for the breach of the contract. That's what you buy. That's what you buy when you actually pay a transfer fee. The only thing that you pay is the fact that you are not going to be facing a claim, and a claim in this case before FIFA. That's also the interesting part, not in the national court.
As briefly mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, in 2024, the CGEU handed down another landmark ruling concerning football player Lassana Diarra. What was this case about?
So Diarra was at that point in time playing for a Russian club and decided to just leave. And allegedly had an offer from a Belgium club, Charleroi. The issue was that Charleroi in the end renounced recruiting him because there was a risk also for the club that it would have to pay compensation to the Russian club, because Diarra would have breached his contract, what is called in the jargon of the transfer system of FIFA, without just a cause, without having a good reason, and therefore had to pay compensation to the Russian club. And the whole case is about how FIFA, through what is called the regulations on the status and transfer of players, basically regulates the way one can breach one's contract with a club and be then recruited by a new club. And these regulations create a parallel system to the national labor law. If you breach your contract, I breach my contract, under a fixed-term contract, we might owe compensation, and basically our former employer will go to court, potentially, to ask for compensation. In practice, this never happens because it's too costly for a low salary employee to do that. But here we are in a different situation, because actually the player has a labor contract. So he is still employed by another football club. What happens is he decides to just breach the contract. And unlike in real life, FIFA will impose a range of sanctions and liabilities that make it necessary for the new club to actually avoid a complaint, avoid a claim, avoid being dragged before the FIFA dispute resolution chamber first. So this is a private body of FIFA, and thereafter before the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Because the new club and the player face considerable risks that they would not face before a national court. They face risks that are connected to the amount of compensation. So the CAS, the Court of Arbitration for Sport, has interpreted damage as including the cost of paying a transfer fee to recruit the player. So not only what you pay to the player, but also the transfer fee that was paid to recruit the player. So that has created, again, a value in terms of compensation to pay that is much higher than what would be allocated probably in a national court. And then, in addition, the FIFA regulations on the status and transfer of players provide for two things. In certain situations, especially when the player breaches a contract in the first years after he signed the contract, the player will face a potential ban, a potential sanction, in the sense that he would not be able to play football for 4 to 6 months, which would be like, for a career of a football player lasts 10 years, a career of a normal worker would last 30 to 40 years. So you can imagine it would be like, in our case, being precluded from exercising our work for 1.5, 2 years. So that's quite a heavy sanction in proportion. And then, in addition to that, the RSCP foresees, and this is one of the specificities, again, of the regulations compared to any labor law around the world, that the new club is automatically liable for the financial compensation. It becomes a risk, a financial risk for the clubs. That's why they pay those fees.
If you try to understand this for yourself, this means that if you breach a contract with your current employer and get hired by another company a few months later, your former employer cannot take your new employer to court to make them pay for the damages you owe for breaking the contract. However, as Dr. Duval explains, this is possible in football. That is why it is necessary for clubs to pay those fees, as otherwise it becomes a financial risk. Evidently, the Diarra judgment, held by the CGEU, didn't just make waves. It became an instant landmark ruling. But why is that? And in what ways does it offer the opportunity for the transfer system to shift in favor of the players?
The Diarra case was a case in which, again, the player this time has unilaterally breached his contract, and just the new club didn't want to recruit him because of the risk that the new club was facing. And basically, the player is then demanding damages on the basis of a breach of competition law before the Belgium courts. And the Belgian court referred the case to the Court of Justice, and the Court of Justice concluded, and this is the core of the Diarra case, that basically the way the regulations, the FIFA regulations, calculate damages is contrary to both EU free movement law and EU competition law. And the fact that there is an automatic joint liability of the new club is also contrary to free movement law and competition law. And the fact that the club cannot, the player is not automatically given an administrative authorization to register with the new associations is also contrary to EU free movement and EU competition law. And basically, in particular, the first two, the way you calculate compensations and the presumption of liability of the new club, of joint liability of the new club, those two are essential pillars for, again, the existence of the transfer market, because they constitute, again, referring to what I just said, the value of the player. And that's a fundamental challenge to how the transfer market operates, and potentially an opportunity, and that's what I've been writing about, to rethink the transfer market. But we also see that actually social norms are extremely powerful Because right now, if you read your newspaper, and again, I mean, you must be one of the few ones that still reads it on paper, and I commend you for that. But, or if you follow on social media football commentators, you will see that we are facing a lot of transfers that are happening right now in this winter window. And you can ask me, but well, in the end, nothing changed. Well, to some extent, you're right, nothing changed. And the main reason for it is actually social norms. It's because the actors have been reluctant to actually make use of the caseload. And both on the player's side and probably the agents play a key role there. Players have been reluctant to just breach their contract and take a risk. And clubs have been reluctant to apparently encourage players to do so and willing to still continue to pay transfer fees. While in practice, the legal framework that made it necessary is not there anymore or is fundamentally challenged by the Diarra case.
In essence, the Diarra judgment paves the way for players to transfer clubs without facing heavy financial penalties for breach of contract, and for clubs to sign new players without paying a transfer fee to their former club, a potential game changer. Yet, surprisingly, it seems that the players and clubs are hesitant to jump on this opportunity. Why is that?
The main problem might be with the players. I mean, they have to breach first their contract. So they have to decide to say, I quit, and I might face consequences. And that jump to say I quit can be scary if you're not sure about the consequences. And so it might be that in particular agents who have a vested interest in large transfer fees, because they derive a lot of income from those large transfer fees, and agents play a key role in advising players and basically regulating the labor market. It might be that agents in general are very reluctant to encourage their players to actually breach a contract and are telling them, oh, no, we should. I mean, you heard that in the radio, this crazy French researchers from the ASA Institute said you can leave, but I would not do that. I mean, the risks are enormous. Don't do it. And they would have a huge influence on a very young player, very promising, who doesn't want to ruin his career. They might say, you know, you're going to be blackmailed. Nobody will recruit you anymore. There are lots of ways in which, and here again, an interesting interaction between social norm and legal norms, in which social norms and social pressure might achieve an objective that was protected until now by legal norms. However, legal norms play an important role to ensure that there is continuity in a certain social arrangement. So it might be that we're just waiting for one big player to actually do it. And if one big player does it and is encouraged to do so, and everybody sees that nothing happens, and that player actually signs in a big club with a big bonus and a big contract in terms of wage, then that might totally change the dynamic. So we might be just one big player away from a big change in the way the transfer market operates. But at this point, I think the main reason why it's not happening is not so much at clubs, and it might happen as well that they just agreed informally, they build a cartel and say, we will not recruit a player who has breached unilaterally their contract. So that might also happen. But I think that's quite difficult at the global level. So to have all the clubs agree on that. But I think it's more like on the player side right now, we haven't found an angry enough player with an agent that or a lawyer that actually provides serious legal advice to actually just quit and say, no, I just quit. I use the Jarrah case law. You cannot do anything against me besides asking for compensation, and this compensation will be reasonable, much less than what you're asking in terms of transfer fee, and I'll just pocket the difference. And once that will happen, then we will see a profound change in the market. But what I think is we will see a re-regulation before that happens. So there will be a new transfer system that will be put in place through an agreement between the Football Players Union, FIFA, and the European club associations and the club representatives.
It's clear that football isn't just a game. It's a web of regulations shaped by multiple governing bodies. In this episode, we have already mentioned key players like FIFA, the Football Players Union, and the European Clubs Association. With different institutions operating across various jurisdictions, football naturally falls under the umbrella of transnational law. Philip Jessop defined transnational law to include all law which regulates actions or events that transcend national frontiers. Both public and private international law is included, as are other rules which do not wholly fit into such standard categories. To try and make this more tangible, Dr. Duval considers how the governance of international football is shaped globally.
I believe this field clearly shows the value of thinking beyond the categories of national and international. And therefore leveraging the idea of transnational that would bridge or assemble different, more neatly defined legal spaces into one assemblage, that's also a concept I've used, which constitute, again, through processes, norms, practices, the governance of sports. And in the sporting context, it's just so clear in the context of sports. And let me take a concrete example. You think of, for example, the regulation of doping and how basically at a global scale athletes are being controlled and regulated in terms of what type of products they use to enhance their performances. Well, if you look at this, again, assemblage, it is composed of so many different regulatory sources in terms of norms, for example. So you have a World Anti-Doping Code, which is a product of a Swiss foundation. It has actually as such no value. It binds nobody. It is just a code that is produced by a Swiss foundation. However, it is in relation with contractual provisions of Swiss associations, but not only Swiss associations, also associations based in other countries like Monaco, if you think of the World Athletics, which might make that World Anti-Doping Code binding for their affiliates. So here again, through the bindingness of the rules of a Swiss association, the code that as such has no value or no bindingness to anybody becomes binding for a particular category of people through the intermediary of Swiss civil law. But additionally, and importantly, you have also a UNESCO convention, which has been signed by a great number of countries. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it is the UNESCO Convention on Anti-Doping that is the most ratified in terms of UNESCO conventions, and which is there to support the implementation of the code. And then you have a lot of national legislations, many different national legislations, which are there to implement, in a way, the UNESCO Convention and transpose the code into national administrative law, or criminal law, and allow also an enforcement of the code, but this time by national administrative authorities or national police authorities. And so you start to see a picture that is so complex that it cannot be subsumed under the idea of international law. And this is not international law. The part of international law of the world anti-doping regime is super limited to one UNESCO convention and as well one convention of the Council of Europe. And at the same time, it's not also national law. If you would look at it from a national law perspective, you would see only the administrative regulations, potentially the national legislation, but you will not really understand the context of those legislation and understand the content of those legislation without understanding the role played, for example, by the World Anti-Doping Agency and the World Anti-Doping Code. And you would miss entirely the role played by sports governing bodies through their private regulations in also implementing and enforcing that code. So, in a way, this is an area, this is a reality that one cannot capture with ideas that reduce law to either a national law or an international law and reduce it to the product of states. This is a world where everything is enmeshed and an assemblage that I think can be best captured by the idea of transnational law. And I like the idea of transnational law versus global law because it still allows for differentiation. So global law has a bit, this resonates as a kind of unique law. While transnational law, and this is also very visible in the world anti-doping regime, allows for differentiations in different contexts. And anti-doping doesn't look at all the same if you're based in Kenya or if you're based in Russia or if you're based in France. Because exactly for the reason that it is an assemblage and that it depends a lot on how World Anti-Doping Code is being translated into national law by national institutions. So it is a transnational law that might take different forms depending on where you are on the planet. And that's also reflected in the idea of the transnational more than in the idea of the global.
As mentioned, football is a truly international sport, bringing people together and sustaining a massive influential market. But with that global reach comes challenges that can't be overlooked. The next FIFA's Men's World Cup is set to take place in Saudi Arabia in 2034. This has raised significant international legal concerns, particularly regarding labor rights and human rights issues. Similar to the backlash faced by Qatar in the lead-up to the 2022 Men's World Cup, global organizations such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have voiced concerns over migrant worker conditions, the enforcement of labor laws, and the use of the event for sports washing. Notably, Qatar, after intense international pressure, adopted legislative reforms, including the dismantling of the controversial kafala system, through the introduction of minimum wage and improvements of worker mobility. However, some reports suggest that gaps remain between those legal reforms and their implementation. And so, with Saudi Arabia now facing similar scrutiny, what are the legal considerations at play?
I think this is a tremendously difficult issue. I also think that it's easy to paint it in black and white, and it's more nuanced, obviously. I think one should not, underestimate the fact that there is definitely legitimacy in having a World Cup that is not always in between France, England, Germany, the United States, and Japan. I mean, there are other ways to organize societies that we do not necessarily recognize as always and still have also the right to host be it Olympic Games or World Cups and so on. So it's not an easy question. Where do you draw the line and under which conditions? And then there's here in particular with Saudi Arabia, we're facing a bit of a similar debate, I think, than the one that was at the center around the Qatar World Cup, which is the rights of migrant workers. And to some extent, here we are talking about rights of workers that are the polar opposite of football players, at least of football players who are attracting the type of transfer fees that we were discussing earlier. On the one hand, we have football players which are luxury migrant workers on demand that get absolutely unimaginable contracts for us in terms of their wages, in terms of their different types of benefits, in terms of their way of life. And on the other hand, we have the polar opposite, which are migrant workers in the Gulf who are being exploited to the maximum in terms of both the wage that they are earning, but also their working and living conditions. So it's a bit of a tale of two different worlds that are meeting. And two really opposite worlds. And in the context of Saudi Arabia, we will have again a lot of discussions about the people that are involved in the building sites that are connected to the organization of the World Cup. But also beyond the World Cup, I mean, you might have heard of this crazy city, a neon that is being built in the middle of the desert. I don't want exactly the line. I don't want to experience whatever the working conditions are on that site, but also living some conditions around that site. I think part of it is to think about it in also in terms of transformation, how to change those conditions. I think the Qatar experience has shown that counter-marketing, counter-ambush marketing, hasn't been that effective in achieving change for the workers. There have been quite a few, let's say, formal legislative changes, but in practice, the people working on those work sites are facing still very low wages, very precarious migrant status that are being leveraged to exploit them, living conditions that are still extremely difficult, etc., etc. So the changes achieved have been relatively minor, if any, and not necessarily long lasting in terms of how they are being rewinded afterwards. So yeah, I'm not sure how to approach now the Saudi Arabia World Cup. I think from my perspective, it will need to be done differently strategically by those who want to represent or support the rights of migrant workers. There might be a need to find a way, and I'm not sure how, but I think this is potentially more fruitful in terms of achieving any type of change connected to leveraging a sports event. To try to support organization of workers, to try to support ways for them to exercise leverage collectively, try to put pressure through the countries of origin, try to tackle the reasons, the original reasons that pushed those workers towards making a very dangerous bet on a very uncertain future outside of their environment of origin. I think so it's in a way much more difficult than just making a scandal out of something. It demands more long-term engagement with the people concerned. It demands investing in organization and to some extent having skin in the game. So not only advertising a difficult situation, but also taking risks in terms of your own safety in organizing. And potentially also doing things that are less visible or less easily to communicate to the wider public, in the sense of doing work in the countries of origin to try to limit and inform as much as possible those who are inclined to migrate. So I think we are, I doubt that will be the strategy selected, because it's much easier to just follow the playbook of Qatar and do it again a bit the same way, try to blame FIFA, try to make a lot of publicity around the way Saudi Arabia regulates or deregulates labor and migration. I'm not convinced that would be a very successful strategy.
There has been growing cynicism regarding the effectiveness of human rights organizations in driving real change, but also the inability to separate human rights advocacy from political agendas. Lara Montesinos-Coleman, for instance, comments that human rights and international law have been masking imperialist domination. Similarly, Ari Nir suggests that these organizations reinforce the very institutions they claim to challenge. If that is the case, how can change occur, particularly concerning labor rights and the rights of migrants?
I am a believer that in the fact that we need to be political. So I'm more on Hannah Arendt's side. We need right to have rights. And those rights, they do not stem from an abstract construct. They stem from human institutions. So part of it is the implication of this for me, or the way I understand that position, is that, or the situation right now, is that we have a bit of an issue in terms of the location of the political. A lot of our political energy is still concentrated in and on national political institutions, which have lost a lot of power, or which are facing difficult asymmetric relationship with transnational organizations. And so part of my role is, or I see my role as contributing to understanding that bodies like FIFA, IOC, the World Anti-Doping Agency for the sports system are the political centers, and to channel critical energy toward them, channel public attention toward them, and think in terms of institutional reform about them, think in terms of how do I democratize that thing. That's what occupies me. And to a certain extent, when I also look at Qatar or at Saudi Arabia, or, I think here as well, the solution will not come top down, neither from FIFA nor from UEFA nor from IOC nor from the Human Rights Council, nor even from the ILO. Here we need political organization inside those countries by those people. And I mean, it's still, it's difficult for us to understand, but when we are talking about Qatar, we're talking about a place where 95% of the workforce is migrant. And if I'm not mistaken, 90% of the population is a migrant population. So here it's about making sure that, I mean, I think the challenge is really to ensure that that population gets a voice politically in the government of that society. And that, unfortunately, I think will not be possible without organization. And in a way, democracies were made in Europe not through a top-down involvement of the Human Rights Council of the world. They were made through bloody battles in the streets of Paris, London, and Berlin. And they were made through occupations, they were made through resistance, they were, and I don't think that we can expect our international organizations to actually achieve more democratic arrangements in societies without really a strong mobilization on the ground. So that's my position, and it's a way a position that is quite skeptical about the role of international law or human rights law in achieving super strong change. It doesn't mean that I think there is no role for it. I also think that human rights law can be a language that we use to politicize, to politicize certain questions, especially when transnational actors, again, taking it back to sports, because in a way, the labor law situation in Qatar is much more dependent on here local law than transnational sports law. But talking about how we regulate anti-doping, I think human rights can be a way to mobilize athletes, to engage in collective action, to change the way anti-doping regulation is being done, if one believes that there is an issue with it. So I do not think that there is no place for human rights for the language, but I also think that change and fundamental change will not pass through only human rights processes.
That concludes today's episode, where we've explored the intricate governance of football with Dr. Duval. From the historical shifts in the transfer system following the Bosman ruling to the implications of the Diarra case, we've gained valuable insights into how legal developments are reshaping player mobility and the underlying structures of football governance. And Dr. Duval's considerations on the intersection of FIFA's regulations, the World Anti-Doping Code, and national legal systems offer a glimpse into the complexities of what has become a layered system of governance. Dr. Duval's perspective on the transfer system, once seen as buying and selling players, revealed the deeper legal mechanisms at play, highlighting that clubs aren't simply trading players, but rather negotiating the rights of previous clubs to claim damages in case of a contract breach. The Diarra ruling has raised significant questions about the future of the system, particularly considering the CGU has ruled it to be contrary to EU competition and free movement laws. However, while this case offers an opportunity for players and clubs to rethink the existing system, social norms have so far prevented any widespread change. It could take one player daring to take on this challenge for a trickle-down effect to completely shift the system. Our conversation touched on the upcoming 2034 FIFA Men's World Cup in Saudi Arabia, highlighting the stark contrast between the rights of professional football players and the vulnerabilities of migrant workers constructing the tournament's infrastructure. This juxtaposition raises critical questions about how to protect all individuals involved in a game, not just those on the field, and how to drive meaningful institutional reform. Dr. Duval emphasizes that real change will require more than human rights processes. It will demand political organizations stepping up to advocate for progress. In today's evolving global sports landscape, it is clear that the legal frameworks governing football must also evolve. We hope today's episode has provided you with a deeper understanding of the transnational legal system that governs football and the complex issues that arise from them. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to exploring more of these crucial topics with you in future episodes.